Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
But given our needs, given the absolute necessity for growth, given the future, the truth is joining John Bonacieux is every bit as certain as death and taxes.
Death and taxes?
Yes.
Death and taxes?
Yes.
But an odd pairing.
It's just a saying, Mr. Black.
By whom?
You're not familiar with the phrase, in this world nothing is certain but death and taxes?
Well, I am now.
That little exchange is from the 1998 movie Meet Joe Black. Brad Pitt is cast as an unlikely Grim Reaper, and he's surprised and maybe even a bit tickled to discover that his own inevitability as death is commonly mentioned in the same breath with the certainty of taxes. And I can see why it might seem to be an overstatement. I mean, compared to death, taxes seem relatively minor. But remember, even the mighty have been felled by excursion into evasion.
What is this? If we can establish that any of these coded entries indicate payment to Capone, then we can put Capone away.
Yes, it might be tempting to sidestep the Treasury Department altogether, but if you watch enough Hollywood movies, from The Untouchables to The Firm to The Wolf on Wall Street, you'll notice a different lesson emerge. Don't evade taxes and risk jail. Secure a crafty accountant to keep more of your coins in your pocket while staying just on this side of the law. Heck, in 1994's Shawshank Redemption, Andy Dufresne uses his pre-incarceration accounting skills to cheat death and eke out a little justice in a corrupt system.
If you want to keep all that money, give it to your wife. The IRS allows a one-time only gift to your spouse for up to $60,000.
Bullshit. Tax-free?
Tax-free. IRS can't touch 1 cent.
It's perfectly legal. Go ask the IRS. They'll say the same thing. But you do need someone to set up the tax-free gift for you. I suppose I could set it up for you. That would save you some money. You get the forms, I'll prepare them for you, nearly free of charge. I'd only ask 3 beers apiece for each of my co-workers.
And apparently, the state of South Dakota is offering a masterclass in this powerful loophole lesson. Just a little over a month ago, an unprecedented global investigation leaked nearly 12 million financial documents to the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists in Washington and over 600 journalists around the world. Called the Pandora Papers, the documents give the public a glimpse into a shadow financial system benefiting the world's most wealthy and powerful. And among the most surprising is that the United States has become a major tax haven for foreign assets. The primary location for these assets?
Hail South Dakota, a great state of the land. Health, wealth, and beauty, that's what makes her grand.
Oh yeah, South Dakota is the new Cayman Islands. Out of the 200 trusts identified in the U.S. by the Pandora Papers, more than 80 of them were located in South Dakota. And the Pandora Papers show that over the past decade, the amount of money in these South Dakota trusts has more than quadrupled to at least $360 billion. But that might not even be the full extent of it. Some financial experts have estimated that as much as $1 trillion could be hiding in South Dakota's trusts. And that's where we start today. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, and this is The Takeaway. Casey Michelle has authored a new book, American Kleptocracy, How the U.S. Created the World's Greatest Money Laundering Scheme in History. It's going to be published in just about a week. Thanks for joining us, Casey.
Thanks so much for having me, Melissa.
So what are the regulations or maybe the deregulations that led up to this moment in South Dakota?
Yeah, Melissa, that's really the kind of trillion-dollar question that we are dealing with right now. As best as we can tell, this transformation of South Dakota, which is, again, part of a far bigger transformation of the U.S. itself into this global leading offshore haven, again, with South Dakota, so few of us paying any attention to this transformation in South Dakota, you really kind of have to go back to the 1980s. This isn't something that happened overnight. This isn't something that happened yesterday. This is something that's really decades in the making, again, with so few of us paying any attention to this, but you know, you think back to the 1980s, you kind of, you know, you remember, especially in places like the American Midwest, in the American Rust Belt, you know, we had agriculture falling on hard times. You had manufacturing in the U.S. falling on hard times, and especially states like South Dakota that were so reliant on these industries, really falling off kind of an economic cliff, along again with a number of other states right here in the U.S. And so what we now know is that the leadership in the state, which was governed at the time by a guy named Bill Janklow, and he had this great nickname, Wild Bill. He was just kind of swaggering, you know, bigger than life politician. You know, he had an idea. He saw kind of an economic lifeline where others were still trying to bring manufacturing or agricultural jobs back. You know, Governor Janklow, he decided to do something else. And that was two things. One, he tried to attract, of all things, the credit card industry into the state of South Dakota. He ended up repealing the interest rate caps on credit cards. Again, you know, we think back 40, 50, 60 years ago, which is, it's almost kind of a foreign idea that there used to be these low, low, low caps on interest rates for credit cards. Now, obviously, we're talking about trillions of dollars of credit card debt. And Janklow said, you know, there's no reason that we need to have those credit card interest rates. Why can't banks just charge what they want in terms of interest rates? And by the way, they can come to South Dakota and do that. And lo and behold, some banks took them up on that. And that's one of the reasons South Dakota is the leader in the credit card industry. What we saw from that, though, is that Janklow realized what a success that could be, what a success these financial deregulations could be. And he saw something else. He saw there was another opportunity when it came to trusts. So what we're talking about South Dakota, we're talking about offshoring and financial secrecy and large, all these illicit and suspect and dirty money assets from abroad coming into South Dakota. We're talking not about the credit card industry, but we're talking about trust. No trust.
Okay, you know, Casey, hold on. I want to ask one thing. How do we know the money's dirty? I mean, in part, as I'm listening, I'm taking notes. Like, okay, you know, when your state has fallen on hard times, diversify, make some choices, get new industries. And if you're rich, then, you know, find a place to shelter your money. But does that follow that it is dirty money?
Certainly not all of it is dirty money. We know, for instance, that any number of Americans, successful Americans, American entrepreneurs, wealthy Americans who have built industries, who have built companies, have been taking advantage of the financial secrecy provisions in South Dakota. So I'm not saying that all of the money, all of this estimated up to $1 trillion of money that we now know is housed in South Dakota is dirty. But what we do know, and especially what we saw out of the Pandora Papers just a month ago, is that there's every incentive for anybody who has any kind of dirty money burning any hole in their pocket to flock not to the Cayman Islands, not to Switzerland or Panama, but to flock to the newest offshore haven in the world, and that is South Dakota. And again, this is what all those of us who've been researching this field, studying and investigating this transformation in the U.S., you know, we've been trying to ring the alarm bells about this for a few years, that again, there's every incentive for those narco traffickers, those arms traffickers, those oligarchs, those crooked politicians elsewhere, when they're looking to transform their money, looking to hide their money, looking to use their money without anybody being able to track it back to them. We know that South Dakota is now the perfect home for them. So when I say dirty money, we're not talking about the totality of everything in South Dakota. In fact, we only know a fraction of who's actually been taking advantage of South Dakota. But we do know that even within that fraction, we have rights abusers, we have those who are responsible for environmental crimes, we have corrupt or crooked politicians that are flouting local laws and moving and hiding their money for themselves, for their families, for their friends, and then being able to do whatever they want with it because nobody can track it back to them.
If I'm average Joe South Dakotan, how did these deregulations that are allowing this new sort of influx of foreign dollars, how did it impact my life?
Well, you know what's funny, Melissa? If you're an average South Dakotan, this didn't actually end up impacting your life that much. This didn't bring in tens or hundreds of thousands of jobs into South Dakota. Heck, the South Dakota government doesn't even necessarily see any revenue from all of these trusts coming into the state, all of these figures coming into the state. What we saw is that white-collar accountants, white-collar financial managers, white-collar lawyers, this kind of upper crust, well-educated, well-trained cohort of professional class South Dakotans, those were the ones that really benefited. So we're not talking about the farmers. We're not talking about those who actually lost their jobs in the manufacturing base. What we saw instead was an influx of white-collar professionals into the state. Again, these are the trust managers. These are the accountants. These are the lawyers that then are able to, in this case, bankroll local politicians, bankroll local political forces, and really ingratiate themselves with the South Dakota legislature. You know, in political science, they have this term captured state. Mm-hmm. When you have local legislators that are effectively betrothed to or intimately connected with a single industry, you know, think of oil and gas in Texas, or think of, you know, in this case, shell companies in Delaware. What South Dakota now has is it's been effectively captured by the wealthy, powerful clique that runs the trust industry in South Dakota. So ironically enough, we're not, again, talking about tens of thousands of jobs that will affect the average South Dakotan. We're talking about those who are most closely connected to the South Dakota legislature that have been benefiting for years and years and years. And again, attracting and incentivizing the inflows of all of this questionable, suspect, anonymous, and in many cases, as we now know, dirty money into the state. And there's no reason to think that that won't continue for the foreseeable future.
And typically, Casey, with a captured state, partisanship doesn't matter, and nor does ideology. You know, it doesn't really matter what party the mayor of Detroit is from. The mayor of Detroit is always going to, right, be captured by the auto industry is kind of the claim, right? Is that similar here? Do we see across ideology, across party, that capture in South Dakota?
We have seen that exactly for decades. It doesn't matter what side of the political aisle the legislators are on. Time and time and time again, across the political aisle, these legislators have supported the growth of the expansion of and the entrenchment of this trust industry. I mean, I think a great case in point for that is one of the things the governor did is not only did he create the incredible deregulatory moves, but one of the things that he did, which is frankly kind of a genius move on his part, for however horrific the outcome of this has been afterward, is he actually created what is called a trust task force. So when we're talking about captured states, it doesn't get more kind of in your face than this trust task force, because who are the people on this task force? You have the state legislatures, some of them in the state house, in the state senate, and then on the other side of the task force, you have those professionals that are running the trust industry. So the task force is kind of a meeting of the minds, where you have the professionals in the trust industry directly recommending, directly telling the legislators what specific policies should they implement, what specific bills should they pass, and what specific deregulations should they make sure to implement so South Dakota can still remain at the head of this explosion of the offshore economy here in the U.S.
Okay, so, you know, again, if I think about television or movies, I'm thinking about the bad guys are on their boat in the Cayman Islands, or maybe they're hiding money in Switzerland or Bermuda. I guess I can't imagine them out, in the Badlands in South Dakota.
Well, you know, what's funny, Melissa, is the beauty of South Dakota is similar to a couple other states that have also really refined the practice of offshore wealth here in the U.S. But really, the beauty of South Dakota is these guys never have to set foot in the state of South Dakota. They never actually have to go to, you know, Sioux Falls or to Pierre in the capital. All they have to do is make a phone call. All they have to do is send an email, or maybe even better yet, hire an American lawyer or a South Dakota lawyer to do that for them. And then, oh, by the way, add that added level of secrecy with the attorney-client privilege. So when you say you can't imagine these guys out in the Badlands, you know, Melissa, you're exactly right. They never go to the Badlands. They never go to South Dakota. They just use their computer. They use their phone to set something up right there in the state. And again, the state has made it so, so, so easy for them to do so. All they want to do in South Dakota, all the legislature wants to do is make it as easy and quick and simple a process as possible for these oligarchs, for these kleptocrats, for these criminal or corrupt figures abroad to move their money, to house their money, to launder their money, and then be able to enjoy their money for as long as they want without anybody else being able to track it back to them.
Okay, is this fundamentally different than the ways that wealthy people and wealthy corporations have been hiding their money kind of forever? Like, is this just an outrage because we don't have the same cash they do?
You know, what's funny about that, Melissa, is that you are in so many ways exactly right. Or you're hitting on a specific reality and dynamic in the kind of growth of the global offshoring economy. And again, when we're talking about the global offshoring economy, we're talking about an estimated tens of trillions of dollars right now. We're talking about an offshoring economy with the equivalent GDP of something like China. So it's almost kind of an offshore superpower. And you think of these traditional offshore havens, again, the Caymans or British Virgin Islands, Switzerland and Panama, that have been really providing so many of these similar services. And again, South Dakota is not the only jurisdiction that provides, in this case, anonymous perpetual trust. We see this elsewhere. But what happened in places like South Dakota or Delaware or Wyoming or other parts of the U.S. is that American legislators or South Dakotan legislators, they realized that there is this incredible geyser of illicit, suspect, dirty money that is just erupting around the world and looking for a home. And what they realize is that you have the marriage of a few different things, the marriage of American private property rights, you have the American legal regime, and then even beyond that, you have South Dakota as a sovereign state. You know, we still have a federal polity here in the U.S. South Dakota can create its own regulations. It can create its own kind of financial architecture to attract that. So what we really had, and again, this is another political science term, is a race to the bottom, not only among American states, but among all of these global offshore jurisdictions, a race to see who can provide the most secrecy, the most protections, the most, as another journalist said, potent force field for hiding your wealth for yourself, for your family, for your children, for your friends, for the rest of your regime, for as long as you possibly want.
Who else is in the race?
Well, certainly here in the U.S., we have a number of states. We have, again, South Dakota on the anonymous trust side. But when we're talking about things like anonymous shell companies, which is, again, a very popular building block of the broader offshoring architecture, you got to think of states like Delaware. You got to think of states like Wyoming, states like Nevada. Again, some of these smaller states that maybe don't have as much natural resources or industry, but that nonetheless realized that, again, there's trillions and trillions of dollars floating around the offshore world looking for a home, looking to be hidden and anonymized and laundered. And again, you have all these American states that realize they can tap into that. They can provide new jobs for certain professionals. They can, as we see in certain states, even take commission of some of that money that comes in to help fund state budgets. So they can even go beyond that and begin cutting taxes elsewhere for constituents. So you have this dynamic that builds upon itself. And again, we see this in the U.S., we see this in other offshore jurisdictions elsewhere, but it's the same story time and again. It's these smaller states, smaller jurisdictions that realize they have the actual legal and financial power to create this kind of architecture to hide all of this money. I mean, it's really more money than you could kind of imagine. It's too big to see in many ways. And we're only just now learning about the depths to which South Dakota has sunk and who's been taking advantage.
Does the federal government have any incentive to step in and regulate this?
The short answer is yes. And that's for a few reasons. You know, if you think about the federal government, you know, the U.S. still likes to position itself as this kind of global anti-kleptocracy leader. In many ways, the U.S. is. You know, it was the first country to criminalize the bribing of foreign officials. It was the first country to criminalize money laundering in and of itself. And I know certainly the Biden administration and many in Congress would like to make sure that the U.S. is still seen as a leader in the fight against corruption, in the fight against offshoring. You know, it's tough for American officials to look foreign counterparts in the eye and say, you need to clean up your offshoring sector, when all they have to do is come back and say, well, what about Delaware? What about South Dakota? You know, that's one dynamic. But the other one is that, you know, the more this this offshoring world continues to exist and expand, and the more places like South Dakota continue to kind of feast at this trough of suspect and dirty money, that dynamic, that can't last perpetually. Something is going to break, because what you have is populations in developing countries that are watching their crooked or corrupt political figures loot education budgets, health budgets, infrastructure budgets, really decimate local populations and soak up so much of the wealth that should be for those populations. We know what that leads to. That leads to domestic instability, that leads to revolution, that leads to civil war, that eventually leads to national security concerns for the U.S., or it leads to immigration crises that, as we see right here in the U.S., do impact those of us here in the United States of America. So you have also these national security concerns that are absolutely going to come and are absolutely going to accelerate because of what South Dakota has transformed into. So yes, Melissa, absolutely the U.S. federal government has an interest in cleaning this up, and we're finally beginning to see signs of them beginning to do something about it.
Casey Michelle, Casey's new book, American Kleptocracy, How the U.S. Created the World's Greatest Money Laundering Scheme in History, is going to be published very soon. Be on the lookout and be sure you read it. Casey, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks so much, Melissa.
In the 11th century, leprosy became pandemic in Europe. The experience connected moral and social stigma to physical ailment and disability. In the 14th century, the plague killed a full third of the world's population, and this Black Death fundamentally altered the social, political, and economic realities of the globe as the existing European feudal system collapsed under the weight of worker shortages, land abundance, and inflation. The 19th century cholera pandemics fueled anti-Asian sentiment and stoked international tensions. While the 20th century AIDS epidemic gave cover to homophobic public policies. See, pandemics shape and direct human societies, claiming lives, upending economies, fueling hatreds, but also birthing movements, reordering power relations, and altering means and modes of production. This is true of COVID-19 as well. So take a deep breath and settle in, folks, because there is no moment just over the horizon when the bell towers are going to ring in the town square, letting us know it's over, all is safe, return to normal. Worldwide, coronavirus has claimed more than 5 million lives. And while the November 2021 curve is much flatter than November 2020, hundreds of thousands of cases are reported daily. The world we live in now is different. According to Professor Alan Brandt, this is not about living in a COVID-19 crisis. It's about living in a COVID-19 era. Professor Brandt is a historian of science and medicine at Harvard University. Professor Brandt, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thanks for having me on.
So tell us more about what it means to say that we're living in the COVID-19 era.
We all had been hopeful that this would come and it would go. And even a year ago, as we began to get access to vaccines, we had the hope that in a year or two, this would just be gone. But I think we're learning now that that is certainly not the case. This is going to be difficult. It's going to be with us for a long time. And it's creating massive social, political, and economic change, not to mention all the small and large changes that we've had to make in our lives. COVID will have and is having a gigantic impact, and we're going to be dealing with the repercussions of COVID even when the infection may become largely under control.
That global aspect feels like an important part of this. If you look at the vaccination map, it maps almost perfectly onto GDP. Wealthy nations with high GDP are vaccinated up above 50 and 60%. Nearly the entire continent of Africa is without vaccination at all. Is the reason that we're living in an era instead of just a crisis because we simply didn't distribute the vaccines equitably?
You can't control a pandemic disease only in some places and some countries and expect to really end a pandemic. I think the inequity in the way that we've distributed vaccines is a really telling instance of much larger global inequities, which have existed for a long time. But until we can address how poorly we have done at distributing vaccines, making them accessible, encouraging people to take them, making them truly available, then we're going to be dealing with COVID, you know, for much longer than we will need to be.
Early on in the pandemic, Professor Brandt, we heard these kind of horrifying social Darwinian discourse about thinning the herd and letting the weakest die off. Is that how pandemics have shaped the world, that populations emerge sort of healthier or more robust and stronger on the other side?
No, in fact, that's not how pandemics generally work. Although one of the things we find with pandemics is they reveal what people believe. They reveal their biases or their racism or their notion of genetic purity. So we've seen a lot of that in this pandemic. And what pandemics really reveal are social fractures, our fundamental inequalities, our inability to get medicine and healthcare to people who most need it. So COVID really did turn a light on, and it revealed many shortcomings in the way we've managed health and disease here in the United States, but especially around the world. And if we can't get people vaccinated, what we're really doing is we're exacerbating previously existing health inequalities.
I was fascinated to read about how the plague gave even serfs an ability to negotiate for higher prices for their labor. And as we're watching in an American labor shortage, at least as it's being described, or the Great Resignation, I'm wondering if maybe the other side of this troubling inequity narrative about pandemics is that it also seems to have given at least American workers some greater ability to negotiate a higher pay for their labor.
That's a really interesting observation. And I've been watching this, you know, union movements at places like Amazon. And there are possibilities that in pandemics, there are opportunities. One of the things I often point out is that no one would have expected that we would have a constitutional right to marriage equality at the beginning of the AIDS epidemic. But without the activism and the advocacy and the forethought, all those things were triggered in part by HIV and to some degree, increasing tolerance of people who are gay was one of the ramifications of the AIDS epidemic. So there are elements where we can see potentials for a more just society in an epidemic like this, but we also have to be very careful that it doesn't exacerbate existing inequalities.
I'm wondering about the notion of an end. And if we're in an endemic phase, if we're moving to a time when COVID is simply going to kind of be with us, maybe not unlike HIV AIDS, something that is now certainly still very much in communities and has that kind of inequitable impact on communities, I'm wondering how policymakers should be thinking about this. I mean, for months before the vaccine was available, it was, you know, wait until spring, wait until summer, wait until there's a vaccine. But if this is just life now, should we be thinking about how we just now live life with this communicable disease?
Well, I think that is what is going to happen. And there are issues for all of us personally. What's the level of risk we're willing to take? Are we back on airplanes? Do we dine indoors? Do we go to big indoor concerts? All of us will be asking those questions. But from a public policy point of view, we really want to make sure that we have reduced infections and deaths and hospitalizations as much as possible. And this will require continuing to use masks. It will require raising our rates of vaccines and making sure they're accessible to anyone. And we will be living in a phase of considerable uncertainty that was not part of our world before. And what we know about preparedness and preventing deaths is that the healthier we are as a country and a world, the less vulnerable we are to infections like COVID-19.
Professor Alan Brandt, historian of science and medicine at Harvard University, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Carnegie Hall has welcomed a dizzying array of performers.
To have Andy Kaufman, Frank Zappa, and Birgit Nielsen and Horowitz on the same stage, it becomes this kaleidoscope of our history.
I'm Jessica Vosk. Join me for the new podcast, If This Hall Could Talk. It's all about our unique cultural history, as witnessed by one of New York's most beloved institutions, Carnegie Hall. Listen now, wherever you get podcasts.
Hey, Jay, can I get you to hit that applause button, my friend? All right, yes, you at home too. Put your hands together for the nation of Portugal. This small country of just about 10.5 million people is absolutely crushing this whole pandemic situation. Portuguese vaccination rates for those over 50, almost 100%. And for the 25 to 49 crew, Portugal is clocking in at 95% vaccination rate. Even the notoriously challenging young people ages 12 to 17 are at 88% vaccination in Portugal. So, how'd they do it? And what is life like in a fully vaccinated nation? We're joined by Eric Silvers, staff reporter at the Wall Street Journal. Eric, it's great to have you here.
Hi, thanks for having me.
All right, so remind us how COVID-19 played out in Portugal early on. How did it compare to the rest of Europe?
You're absolutely right that they're crushing it now. What's interesting, though, is that they've had sort of a COVID experience that's different than most of the rest of Western Europe, the big countries, including Italy, France, the UK, in the sense that early on in that first sort of COVID, the end of the winter last year into the summer and so on, they thought that they were just going to dodge the whole thing. And then things started picking up in November last year, and then they just went sky high in January, just beyond anything that's even adjusted for population, way higher in cases and deaths than anywhere in Europe. And including the U.S. I mean, one thing that's just shocking, I checked this number so many times when I did this myself. At the height, it would have been the equivalent of 9,500 people dying a day in the U.S. And in the U.S., we never got higher than 3,500 average per day. So they're crushing it now, but they're coming off a really, really, really bad January, February last year. And in fact, one of the, I spoke to a lot of people, obviously, for this story. One thing that's sort of universally accepted by the Portuguese is the fact that the vaccines became widely available here in Europe and in Western Europe, you know, also in the U.S. in January, February, when they were coming off that devastating experience. It really played a factor in convincing people that the vaccine was the way to go.
Yeah, that's precisely what I was going to ask, Eric, is if the very horror of that level of illness and death was the thing that kind of moved the Portuguese past the kind of vaccine hesitancy that we've seen, obviously, in the U.S., but also in many other places, particularly in Eastern Europe as opposed to Western Europe.
I think absolutely. When I was there reporting for the story and I would ask people about January, invariably people would get teary-eyed from the rickshaw drivers, you know, these really like rough and tumble men, you know, middle-aged men who are doing these rickshaws, to virologists or whatever. And it's the equivalent of here in Italy when you talk to people about March of last year. You know, when Italy was sort of the tip of the COVID spear in the Western world, you know, you speak to people, especially I'm based in Milan, as you mentioned, people up here, we're very close to the city of Bergamo, which probably a lot of people in the U.S. now recognize that name. If you just mention March Bergamo here to people, they get this sort of like this visceral reaction. I saw that there when you talk about January of this year. And it's, you know, it's obviously March of last year is fresh, but January of this year is even fresher. So yeah, it's very front and center in everybody's mind.
So what is life like there now, given that the vaccination rates are so high? Is it what would feel like normal?
In a certain sense, it is normal. I went to a soccer game, you know, a big soccer game with a German team that was visiting for this game, and the stadium was packed. So on the surface, you know, you might think this is a soccer game from 2 years ago. But to get into the stadium, you needed what's called the EU COVID certificate, which is similar to the CDC card, though it's digital, and it has a QR code for everybody. And that's attesting that you're vaccinated or you've recovered from the virus, or you've just in the last few days, you've had a negative test. So you're not supposed to get in to the stadium without that. You have to wear a mask in the stadium. Everybody's wearing a mask. You need a mask on the subway to get to the stadium. So that, I mean, that's just that sort of that little slice of life, which, you know, soccer, if anybody knows, soccer is important in Europe and it's really, really important in Portugal. So, I mean, that, I think that's very telling that, you know, they've gone back to normality in the sense that they've got people in the stands, because last soccer season, for most of last soccer season, there was nobody watching. So, I mean, this is a big sort of cultural point, you know, for them, not just Portugal, other countries as well here in Europe. And the masking never became sort of a cultural war issue like it is in the US. So despite this insanely high vaccination rate, all kids are wearing masks in school, 10 years and older, 10 and older, they're wearing masks. All people working in shops have to wear masks. And in the bigger stores, people who are customers have to wear masks.
As you were talking about the kind of, you know, vaccine passport, right? This, you know, you can go to a big event, but you have to prove your safety, you know, relative to a kind of epidemiological public health perspective. It made me think about sort of the immediate post 9/11 moment and flying again. And I can remember thinking 20 years ago, surely there will come a time when we won't be taking our shoes off and, you know, taking all of our things out. But 20 years later, that's just what we do. And, you know, for most people, it's all they even remember flying as. And so I guess I'm wondering, as pandemic becomes endemic, you know, is masking for kids in schools, is sort of demonstrating your vaccination status what we are likely to expect, not only in Western Europe, but in the U.S. as kind of the normal parts of life?
Yeah, I think absolutely in the near term. But I think if you speak to epidemiologists or virologists, nobody expects the COVID to go on forever at this rate where we are. You know, sooner or later, it's going to peter out and it's going to become endemic, kind of like what we think we saw there in Portugal, what I saw there in Portugal. So, yeah, I think masking for the immediate future in countries where it's not such a, you know, such a touch point issue, like, you know, I'm based in Italy and masking is taken pretty seriously here still. But, you know, even the Spanish flu in 1918, I mean, that had a couple of seasons and then petered out. I mean, sooner or later, a respiratory virus like this is going to run its course. You know, all of these things that we do are to try it, help it run its course while having less people get seriously ill and die. So, yeah, so I think it's going to go on for a while. But I hope, as somebody who wears a mask, because I think it's the right thing to do, but I really don't like to do it. I really hope it doesn't end up like the shoes on the when you're going through security at the airport.
Yeah, I hear you on that one. It is certainly more restrictive in our life and our capacity to engage with one another. And at the same time, if it gets us to the next stage more quickly, I'm willing to wear those masks. Eric Silvers is a staff reporter at The Wall Street Journal. Eric, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
We turn now to Navajo Nation, the largest reservation in the U.S. Now, Navajo Nation hasn't quite achieved the 90% vaccination rates of Portugal, but it does boast one of the highest rates of vaccination in the United States. About 70% of tribal members are vaccinated, and the nation continues to enforce strict public health procedures, including a mask mandate throughout the reservation. But despite these strong indicators, the Navajo Nation is experiencing an uptick in new cases. Last spring and into the summer, Navajo Nation was reporting new COVID cases numbering in the single digits. Starting in October, daily counts have frequently been over 100. And while the death toll from COVID remains thankfully low, the new cases are still troubling. Joining me now is Navajo Nation President Jonathan Nez. President Nez, thank you for being here.
Yate, and greetings to you, Melissa, and your listeners, and thank you for having us on the show.
Absolutely. What do you understand to be some of the factors sort of leading to this recent rise in COVID cases?
Melissa, we are like an island within the now United States of America, you know, with cases spiking all around us, and we are 27,000 square miles of land, and it's equivalent, they say, to the size of West Virginia. We do have 400,000 enrolled members, and majority of our citizens live off the Navajo Nation. And so, you know, people have to go to work to make a living. We have a high unemployment rate on the Navajo Nation. So people do have to leave the nation to work to, you know, get their families food and supplies and things like that throughout this pandemic. So, you know, of course, it's going to creep back into our nation. And that's what's happening. It, the daily case count have been fluctuating. Some days we got 30, some days over 100. Like just for instance, yesterday, 89 cases in one day. But as you mentioned earlier, those that live on the Navajo Nation within the 27,000 square mile, 70% of our Navajo adult population, well, 12 years and over, are fully vaccinated. And we do also have a Navajo Nation government vaccination mandate. And because of that, 97% of our Navajo Nation governmental employees are fully vaccinated.
How about mask mandates? Has that had the same kind of sort of divisive politics on Navajo Nation as it has in much of the rest of the nation?
Melissa, I think it's a little different in Indian country. Navajo Nation, we started out a mask mandate in 2020 in April, and we've never lifted that mask mandate to this day. Of course, you have CDC and other places throughout this country who have taken mask mandates off and then back on. But on the Navajo Nation, you know, I think the Navajo Nation people look at it as armor against this modern day monster called COVID-19, because we used our way of life teaching to also assist in pushing back on the virus. And, you know, we have stories about, you know, the Hero Twins coming to the Navajo Nation early on in our immersion stories and fighting off monsters. And today we're fighting this modern day monsters, but at the same time, we're also utilizing our culture and our tradition to let our Navajo citizens know that this modern day monster can be pushed back on by, you know, equipping yourself and putting on your armor. And those, the armor is the mask and also the vaccination. And the masks have been very helpful in keeping the numbers down, including the vaccinations. But there is a concern. Of course, there's a concern throughout this country right now as we go into the holiday season. You know, last year during the holiday season, we see a big spike all over the country in cases. And we are doing everything we can, getting back on the media, getting back on the radio, speaking to our elders and our known Navajo language to let them know these protocols have helped us get to where we're at today and keeping the numbers down. Let's not stop following these protocols. Let's really encourage our Navajo citizens to continue this fight against COVID-19.
And even as you talk about the kind of passing of stories and the you know, the building on origin stories and this, you know, intergenerational knowledge and understanding, it's also true that Navajo Nation lost the pandemic was just brutal early on, particularly for your elders. I'm wondering about that loss of generational knowledge, maybe particularly as we're going into the holiday season, and what that has meant for Navajo Nation.
Right. Our thoughts and prayers go out to the families who lost loved ones. And it's quite inspiring that our elders over 65 years and over, their vaccination rate is over 80%. And so they really took this pandemic very seriously. Of course, many of them had some health issues, and, you know, some of them had to, you know, go through some long-term rehabilitation as well to recover. But overall, our way of life, teaching our culture and tradition will continue, including our language, into the next generation, because it is being taught in schools. And during the pandemic, and I'll end with this, you know, we encourage our young people to relearn their language, their culture and tradition. And a lot of elders really came to the forefront, because our students were at home and our parents were at home during the stay-at-home orders. And we encouraged them to hand down to our younger generation our way of life teaching. And I think there's a renaissance happening as well in Indian country of our teachings.
I'm wondering how the trillion-dollar infrastructure bill may help Navajo Nation to even better prepare for future health crises.
I'm here in Washington, D.C. today. I'll be a part of the signing ceremony at the White House. And I think Indian country is looking forward to seeing some of these dollars improve the quality of life for our Navajo people. 30 to 40% of our Navajo people don't have running water or electricity. And this infrastructure bill will help many of our citizens get the needed water and electricity, broadband, telecommunication, better roads in our communities. And we look forward to seeing an improved Indian country getting us into hopefully the 21st century.
Navajo Nation President Jonathan Nez, thank you so much for speaking with us. And we're going to keep Navajo Nation in our thoughts and in our reporting to be sure that these COVID numbers stay down.
Thank you.
That's all we have for y'all today. And it's just so lovely being here in NYC with the team and bringing y'all some live radio. Before we go, let's start the week off right with a transformative takeaway. I want to shout out 89-year-old Manfred Steiner from Providence, Rhode Island, who just earned his PhD from Brown University and became a physicist. Following World War II, Manfred's mother and uncle talked him into studying medicine. So he did, but he was always fascinated with physics. And once he retired from medicine, he began his studies. And after two decades, he's achieved his lifelong goal. Why did this stand out to me as transformative? Well, it's a little bit of a pep talk for all those grad students out there laboring in years 6, 7, 8 to finish that degree. Don't give up, y'all. Manfred is proof for all of us, actually, that it's never too late to achieve your dreams. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry in New York City, and this is The Takeaway.